Welcome to Draft Sickos, the show on the No Ceilings NBA podcast and feed and YouTube channel, where we cover everybody from the biggest names to the deepest sleepers. I'm your host, Maxwell Baumbach, and today I am joined by Chuck from the Chucking Darts podcast. Chuck, how are you doing today?
Very well. Thank you so much for having me, Maxwell. I'm very excited.
It's great. We got to do this little kind of home and away thing these last few weeks, and wanted you on in particular for this one, because I feel like this is something that you've done a great job kind of staying ahead of the curve on. In the article that I have that'll be up tomorrow on noslingsnba.com, I reference terminology that that has sort of been, to my knowledge, created by you as far as the NQW not quite wing label. But I wrote this gigantic column that has sort of driven me insane over the last week about this column, like, I changed what I was gonna write about like seven different times. So initially the plan was Jonathan Givony, in a recent article, had written about the number of players that have been given up on by their drafted teams in the last couple drafts that were like top 40 picks, like generally not guys that you would see given up on. Additionally, I've been thinking a lot just philosophy wise about smaller guards and like if it makes sense to draft them or not, if they are not meeting certain criteria or thresholds. And I just started researching, and then I ended up writing almost 5,000 words about small guards and positional size and
normal stuff.
Yeah, my wife loved it. She thought it was great that I spent my whole week doing that.
Really, it was a gift to her. Really,
yeah. Basically, the column, the first thing I wanted to look at is like, what is actually like the hit rate on these small guards? Because we hear like, oh, small guard, like, you don't want them, whatever. And there's been some like semi-notable examples in recent years. Guys like Kennedy Chandler and Ty Washington are two that come to mind, who were guys that were really highly touted. And I think if you weren't like deep in the draft bubble at the time, you might not realize it, but there were like a lot of people that viewed them as top 20 prospects. And I think I did, at least with Ty. Like, Ty was a guy I really liked coming out.
I think I had him like 22nd or something. I was close.
And they slid. Like, they went lower than people expected on draft night. And then their teams kind of moved on from them. So I tried to break down the last five drafts, because this is a very recent trend. And I understand anytime you're looking at anything data-wise, you usually want like as big of a sample as possible. But I don't think that would make sense given just how recent this issue is with smaller guards. So I looked at the last five drafts, and I categorized into like hits, guys who were in between, and whiffs. So hits are guys that for the drafting team played more than 20 minutes per game, because I think ultimately the draft is about like, you want to pick guys who contribute for you. And I think that's something that can get lost in draft philosophy sometimes. In betweens are guys that maybe it's too early to tell. Maybe they're just like kicking around the league, but they don't quite meet that like 20 minute a game threshold. And then whiffs were just straight up guys who have not played an NBA minute this season. So to like meet the definition of a whiff, like, you can kind of not be very good and not be a whiff. Like, to be a whiff, like, you've got to be out of the league. So the hit rate on small guards, there've been 33 drafted in the last five drafts, 24.2% have gone over to play, over 20 minutes per game. A lot of guys that didn't meet the hit criteria are still like fine. Like Marcus Sasser is fine. Scoot Henderson is probably going to be a good 20 minute per game player. And like, I didn't include certain guys if they were on like really bad teams or if they haven't proven yet to be good. I'm just going to mark this person as in between. The column goes into greater detail on that process, but it's sort of a mishmash of guys that are okay. And then some huge successes, right? Like John Morant, Darius Garland, Tyrese Maxey, those are all stars. Like, there are good smaller guards still. But the whiff rate, so 14 of those 33 players that are under 6'3 that have been drafted in the last five drafts are out of the league already, which is a very high percentage. And that seemed astonishingly high to me. Particularly just because it kind of shows that like, if you don't hit on a small guard, it's just kind of over. Like, nobody's looking to reclaim these players. If they don't find value immediately, they're just sort of out of the league. So the hit rate on these players is lower comparative to other positions, but the whiff rate is much higher. So it's a 42.4% whiff rate on these smaller players, where for players 6'4 to 6'3, it's 24%. Guys 6'7 to 6'9, it's like 12%. And then it was closer on taller players as well. But basically, like, you are twice as likely to just be out of the league within 5 years if you are a guard who is under 6'3. Let's just kind of stop right there and talk through that. In and of itself, does like that move the needle for you philosophy wise at all? Or like, how does that influence like your understanding or projection of those types of players?
I think it doesn't really like change my philosophy, because I've baked it into the cake. I can say that what is notable about it is how infrequently they get second chances. I think what that speaks to is that whenever a team drafts a player, they want, obviously, the player to succeed. They want to like that player. And so even if you're short, or even if you're raw, if you're behind the eight ball a little bit, there's going to be some period of time, call it like 18 months on average, where the organization is really going to try to nurture you and put resources into you because you are their selection. And even if the signs are pointing toward, you know, the selection maybe wasn't the right one or the best one the team could have made, they still have your back because you're their baby. Think, for example, this may not exactly align, but like the Kings want Davion Mitchell to succeed. And so even though he's had ups and downs, there have been times where he has been a very productive rotational piece, other times where his minutes have been more sporadic, like they're still behind him because they invested a very high draft pick into him. If you lose out and that organization decides to move on, there you don't have that extra goodwill buffer for your second chance. You have to really earn your second chance and prove to a subsequent organization that you are a better option for them than taking a second chance on a wing. And I think that's where a lot of these guys run into difficulty, because all of a sudden it's not, oh, we drafted you, and so let's do everything in our power to make sure you succeed. It's, well, now you have to prove to us why we don't try out this 6'7 guy who shot 36% from three in the G League, and we have a two-way spot available to him. And so that's what I think is such an issue for guys that height, is if you don't fit the type, then you really, like, you have an extra high hurdle to jump over, no pun intended, to try to convince a team that you're worth a second chance.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. And like, yeah, you just really have to thrive to get that opportunity. I talk quite a bit about Kennedy Chandler in the article, because I just think it's interesting that he was a guy who got like one of those small 4-year like guarantee or non-guarantee kind of deals that you can get if you're a second round pick from the Grizzlies. And like, it just wasn't going great in the G League. And then it was just sayonara. Like, that was it. It was over. And he's not played an NBA minute this season. And this is a guy that a lot of people like viewed as a first round prospect. Like, I don't say that to like knock anybody. I probably had him in there. I think a lot of people viewed him as like, hey, this kid was good at Tennessee. He was like the star of the team. I think he showed a lot of intangible stuff that people liked as well.
And a really good athlete, really good athlete.
And like could really jump. Like had shockingly good like block and dunk numbers for a player that size. But I talk about him in relation to Admiral Schofield, who has played minutes this year for the Orlando Magic, who's a guy who's 6'5", but he's like 230. Like, he's just really powerful. He's not been good in the NBA. But if he does start to shoot the way that he shot it in the G League in the past, the way that he shot it when he was at Tennessee alongside Grant Williams, then like, all of a sudden you're in business. Like, he's that close. He's just a jump shot away. Where with Kennedy Chandler, it's like if you're not immediately contributing as a smaller guard, the best case scenario just dwindles so fast. Like, it's just really hard to get 20 minutes a game if you don't have good positional size. And I talked about that as well with Denny Avdia, as well as Trevor Keels, where Trevor Keels was another one of these guys, and he's not a small guard. He was 6'4".
But like kind of groundbound Trevor was. Like very laterally explosive, but not,
above the rim, he was like one of those guys who would get to the paint a lot with like a, like with long strides and a cradle move and finish with a layup. Like it was a lot more of that. He was obviously picked much later than Denny, and like size was part of that. But it's also just easier. The first 3 years of Denny Avdia, you could like put him on the court and he's not going to totally get you killed. Like just by virtue of being taller and sort of knowing how to play and being able to guard multiple positions like competently, even just because you're 6'9", even if a guy is a little bit of a lesser defender, it buys you so much more time because you are able to stay above board, even if your shot isn't there, even if you're not helpful with the spacing. There's more things that you can do on a court when you're 6'9". You can rebound, you can roll to the basket, you're probably going to be a better screener. Like there's all these just little different ways that you can contribute to the game, where when you're a 6'4" guy, you just don't have those if your shot isn't there all the way, or if maybe you have the shot but you're not able to make plays for others the same way. So then you're just a little bit easier to guard because they know that like you're not going to break a defense down with your handle. Like there's just a lot of ways that life can become more complicated for these smaller players. And I think with draft philosophy, a lot of people view it through a playoff lens. And I do as well. Like I very much think about like, what is this player eventually going to look like in a playoff series? But I think even just taking a step back, a lot of the times with some of these smaller players, the question can be something like, what does this guy look like during a regular season game? Mm-hmm. And if in the case of a guy, Trevor Keels, he's probably going to be such a negative that's why he hasn't gotten on the floor this year. Mm-hmm. With a guy like Denny, who is like 6'9" and just knew how to play, it's like, even if he's not great, like he's fine. Like there's worse guys you could trot out there. And the smaller you get, I think the harder it becomes to hit that just like replacement level threshold.
Yeah. And like when you talk about the 20 minute a game barometer, I think it's the ability to get minutes is such an underrated part of doing an evaluation on a given prospect, because getting minutes not only allows you to quote unquote stick, but it allows the best pathway to improve.
Yes, I mean,
the best way to improve at NBA basketball is to play NBA basketball. The same way the best way to improve at, I don't know, professional football is to be in the NFL and to be on the field getting those reps. So if a small guard gets drafted and he, like, let's say he ends up, take Craig Porter Jr., for example, who's good and like does look like he is going to stick, got a guaranteed deal, all the best to Craig. But he is... like he faces the challenge of when that team is fully healthy and they have Garland and Mitchell, you know, Strus can initiate a little bit as a third guard for them. Just like, how is that average 20 minutes going to be close to 20 every night? Or is it going to be, well, when we have injuries, you're going to play 25. When we're at full strength, you're going to play like 12 or 9 or maybe get some DNPs. And that just makes it not impossible to improve as much as sort of your wing counterpart, but it makes it harder. It's just sort of another thing that you have to deal with. Like any, when you mentioned about Keels likely being a negative in the regular season, like any player, doesn't matter what position you play, has to provide some combination of offense and defense such that they are like not killing their team as a young player. Yep. That's really what you have to, it's the barrier you have to break. It's just, don't kill us as a young player. And for so many shorter players, the defensive contribution is like close to nothing. It's just,
it's hard.
It's really very hard to provide defense. And so if that's the
smaller
case,
you get too. Yeah.
And if you're down here, that just means the offensive, like in order to break even, it just has to be so, so high. And the offensive talent in the NBA is so advanced that you have to be real good, real quick in order to stay above water. And it's just like, it's not fair necessarily, but it is a reality that, you know, if you're shorter, it's just going to be harder for you at every single like leg of the journey.
Yep. Yeah. And that's something that stood out too, was like the lowest whiff rate group was 6'7" to 6'9" guys. Yeah. And the hit rate, I believe, was also the best in that group. Which I think is like, it's meaningful, obviously, that like that's where teams are finding success and finding guys that they want to play the most is in that height range. But additionally, like, there's just guys that get more second chances in that group. Like, I bring up, like, Delano Banton, who's on team number three, where, again, it's just, like, Tall knows what he's doing out there. Like, has some feel as a playmaker. Shot has always been a bit of an issue for him. If it wasn't, he would have stuck on the first two teams that he was on. But has the length to defend, moves his feet well, and, like, that can read the opposing offense, and it keeps him on the floor. Whereas like Cassius Winston is, like, not getting that additional opportunity. Like, it's really tough to get your foot back in the door on several occasions. And that's far, like, the whiff rate being so low on that group as well.
Like, I think it used to be that if you were short and a point guard, there was a positive connotation that, like, oh, you know how to run an offense.
Yeah.
And so running an offense is such a valuable trait that there was a place in the NBA for you to, like, for you while while you took your lumps, there was just a place for you. But as the players with guard skills have gotten taller and taller and taller and taller, being that size and, like, does not guarantee that you have that skill set to such a degree that you're a better option to run a second unit than a Banton or some sort of wing. It's just sort of the natural evolution of the game.
When even just, like I mentioned in the column, like, there's more teams that are just willing to run their offense through whoever their best player is.
Right.
But there's also this, like, secondary effects of that too, of, like, the Heat might run their offense through Jimmy Butler, and then when Jimmy Butler goes to the bench, it's like, all right, well, let's try to run some stuff off of Bam, as opposed to, like, okay, now the point guard runs it. It's, like, not even, like, the default second option a lot of the times too. It's second unit will instead be star number two, however big they are, is now kind of the focal point and what everything is flowing through, even if it's not Bam dribbling the ball up the court. Like, there's just different ways that teams are structuring these offenses.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's,
exactly,
yeah, right. Yeah. The column has a lot more stuff in it regarding these other positional size groups to get this in a timely podcast today. We're just going to kind of focus on the small guard part of it. So I do encourage everyone to read the article at noceilingsnba.com that should be up by the time most of you are listening to this. The next kind of thing I took a look at, was sort of the differences. So we looked at, you know, what is the hit rate on this? How does it compare to other positional sizes, which is generally pretty poorly as far as both hit rate and whiff rate. And the next thing was just, like, what is the difference between the smaller guards that are hitting and the smaller guards that are sticking? From an offensive statistics standpoint, there was very little. Like, I looked at a lot of stuff. I looked at pull up 3-point shooting, pull up 2-point shooting. How well did they run pick and rolls? How well were they in spot up settings? True shooting percentage, usage, assist rate, turnover rate. You name it, I took a look at it. And there just was not much of a difference on paper from a pure statistical standpoint between these guys that were drafted that were smaller guards that did make it and those that didn't. Where we did see the differences were largely more defensive factors and physical factors. So there was a higher block rate by nearly double and a lot more low block rate guys in the group that did not pan out. Like, the only low block rate guy that really hit was Peyton Pritchard. Whereas even, like, Emmanuel Quickly was a low block guy in college, but he was at the average mark for the whiff group. But guys like Ja Morant, Tyrese Maxey, Trey Jones, like Davion Mitchell, like, these guys blocked a good number of shots in college, and they measured longer and they measured heavier were the other two things. The average wingspan in the whiff group was around, I think, 6'4", 6'3", pulling that up right now. But no one in the hit group had a wingspan shorter than 6'4". And I think that was the average wingspan in the group that did not stick. So, yeah. And they were about 8 pounds heavier on average too. So if you're coming in heavier, longer, and a bit more ready to defend, it seems like those are really key factors.
And I think that I think that could apply to not just small guard groups as well, because so few prospects that get drafted are expected to handle a large offensive workload. I mean, the ones who are drafted in the top five or top 10 or something. And so every other player, regardless of draft slot or size, is expected to try to help their team in some way other than having a large offensive workload. And that obviously means, look, your best players run the offense. Everyone else has to pick up the slack on defense. And so those defensive factors, like, that makes sense to me that that is a differentiator. The ones who can just do something on defense, something to make life a little easier for their stars who are, who've got the offensive usage covered, are the ones that are, find a way to stick around. And that's why I think, like, the physical factors obviously are chained to that. The fact that, as you mentioned, NBA teams are more willing to just run their offense through their best players. They don't need offense from small players, you know, anymore. What they need from everyone is some sort of defensive coverage. And that's just sort of how team building works now, is you try to find your studs. Your studs are supposed to be offensive studs or two-way studs, but at minimum offensive. And then everything else is just trying to cover for them on the other end of the floor. And so for Quickly is a good example. You know, he's on his second team, but he was a positive player relatively quickly.
Yeah, pretty fast.
Because, you know, of that crazy length and his feel and the way he moved his feet could allow for the defense to survive with him on the floor such that his offensive gifts could make him positive. You know, there's just, you got to provide that. There's some sort of baseline of defensive stability you got to provide so that your offensive talent, which, like, basically every player in the NBA is offensively skewed in some capacity, such that your offensive talent can, like, come through and be good enough to help.
For sure. And I think there's also something to be said for that defensive impact, like, being meaningful in terms of how it helps these guys offensively as well. Like, we talked about how similar these guys are offensively in terms of their statistics, but I think coming in and, like, being able to defend gives them a little bit more of a leash and gives them some more time to figure things out. Yep. And then coming in longer and with a bigger body just sort of makes you a little bit more prepared for the NBA game. Like, I use the example that, like, Marcus Zagorowski had finished similar, like, rim pressure and rim finishing rates to Tyrese Maxey in college. But, like, Tyrese Maxey is worlds faster. He's 9 pounds heavier as a 19-year-old than Zagorowski was as, like, a junior, a senior when he came out. You know, faster, better able to handle contact, and better able to defend just based on how long he was. Technically, he was better. But just coming in with that, it's like, yeah, Marcus Zagorowski might have been the better college finisher than Tyrese Maxey, but, like, you need to project forward to the NBA, and the guy who's coming in with those physical traits is going to pass that other guy every single time. And being able to defend certainly helps him stay on the floor so that he has the time to work out those kinks, where, like, Zagorowski, like, there was a number of reasons that he wasn't able to be on the floor. So those are kind of the big things that I took a look at in the column, was just seeing, yeah, like, where did these guys come in and what are the differences in them? You got to kind of see an early copy of the column. Was there anything else that, like, really stuck out to you or stood out as far as, like, either differences or values or things that really pop? Cause I think the other just final thing is that the guys who were skinnier, cause we're talking about, like, these stockier, stronger guys, had something that made them really special. Like, John Morant's athleticism, even, like, I mean, a guy like Jalen Brunson, stocky, Fred VanVleet gets compared to these guys a lot. Very powerful guy. With Garland, there's this otherworldly touch. Like, there, you really need to be
Matt
special.
Matt Maxey's burst. Yeah. I mean, it's like, I think if you were to take out the players who have gone on to be offensive stars in the NBA, you know, Morant, Maxey, Garland, you know, those types, a lot of whom, even though Maxey was picked in the 20th or
21st, yeah,
like, he was a blue chip prospect, you know, yep, at, you know, one of the Kentucky guards, you know, in that lineage. I think once you're, like, when you get into the nitty gritty of draft eval, like, everyone, not everyone knew that John Morant was a big time prospect his freshman year at Murray State, but his sophomore year, everybody knew that. Like, once the guys who make it obvious are sort of off the board mm-hmm. because of their just outlier talent, then I think a lot of teams just don't really want to do the work on anyone else. Because I think the draft, the real caution in draft evaluation to me is not necessarily drafting someone who doesn't work out. The real caution is passing on someone that will work out and really hit big. Because if you pass on someone that's really good, it means that that player's on a rookie scale deal on another team. You've got to not only beat that player, but now that other team is better positioned to add elsewhere and it just be more complete than yours. And there's going to be so few teams who make the calculation that we cannot afford to pass on this smaller player. Like, we are afraid that this smaller player drafted at 20 or later or 15 or later is going to burn us, which is why I think you still get small guys drafted in the top 10 because you have those outlier talents. But after that, it just falls off a cliff. Because when teams are making that calculation, they're just like, well, it's not going to – if we don't take Marcus Sasser, like, yes, he'll be good, but is Marcus Sasser ever going to really be the difference in a playoff series, or is he going to win them an extra five regular season games? You know, we'll take our chances. Instead, we'll take a shot on, I don't know, Tari Eason or something, from last year. So I think that that is a big part of it. And I just – by the same token, though, that does provide a little bit of opportunity for if you know exactly how a smaller player can contribute to you and like how like look for outlier defensive traits and how a player can be pretty positive, like quickly, who was taken 25th or like
Craig Porter is undrafted. Yeah.
Exactly. Then you can sort of, you can let the draft come to you a little bit, knowing that, well, if nothing else, we'll be able to get this player on the cheap and we'll have a plan for how to integrate them. I know that we're going to talk about some guys in this year's class, but, you know, my guy for a long time, going back to last year, who I really liked is Devin Carter. And I think Devin, I don't know if he's listed at 6'3", 6'4".
He's listed at 6'3", yeah.
So there you go. So he's technically involved in this discussion, but that's why I think that he was such a slept-on player and so valuable. Now, he's been so good this year that his profile's kind of blown up. But if you can identify guys like that, then you can sort of guarantee yourself a decent draft because it's unlikely that they're going to come off the board by the time you pick in the late first round, or you could buy up into the late first round on the cheap to get them, or the early second round or something like that.
Yeah. And I think there is a real value to those type of guys too, where there is like sort of this evident superpower is a phrase that like, I think to myself a lot with like draft prospects, where like with Devin Carter, it was always that he was going to be a very good and a much more versatile defender than most 6'3 guys are by virtue of skill and technique, but also just size. Like the fact that he's so bulky and strong and is going to rebound above his weight. Like it's like I mentioned in the article, like it's just very easy to find complementary guys that are taller. But if you can bring those complementary skills that are common in taller players at 6'3", that is how you get your foot in the door. And that's what a guy like Devin Carter has. And now he's like shooting 44 shots off the bounce and draining them. So it's like, he's going to go high. But yeah, like those are the things that really set guys apart. And to me, like he's just another example of like body, physical tools, defense being the things that really can help you out.
Yeah, all over the place. I guess like Podchemski is probably listed a little taller than 6'3". I think he was listed. He was 6'5"
his like Bartorvik height, which is what I used, was like 6'4". Yeah.
But you see him with his rebounding, the way that he would constantly make himself useful, even if he wasn't like a bad defender, but that was one of his main questions at Santa Clara was how he defended in the WCC. And so as long as you are, it's the sort of thing where if you're going with a sort of statistical framework before you check the tape and everything, like you have to make sure that these guys are really affecting the game in a bunch of different ways, because if they're not, I think it's hard to find the like diamond small player who is not like an all court presence at the college level, because like you're just at that point, like you're really just overthinking it. If he's not an all-court presence there, how is he athletic enough to hang in the NBA? Like you just have to make sure that like you are not, I guess, losing the forest for the trees. You got to look for stuff that is pretty clear on tape that will pop immediately to you, where you're like, this guy is so athletic, he clearly belongs at the next level.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we are going to take a quick break. And then from here, we're going to start to get into different guys in this class and how this information might kind of inform how we're viewing them. So we're going to start with some bigger names, then we'll kind of hit on some smaller guys, pun fully intended, I guess, like smaller names this class, and just kind of see like where we have them relative to other players. So stick with us. We will be back in just a moment. Okay, so the two big small guard names in this class are Rob Dillingham and Reed Sheppard.
Mm-hmm.
I like both these guys quite a bit. Do you have a preference of one over the other? Because I've been a Reed guy over Rob. Are you in that same camp?
Yes. So I did an episode with Kyle Mann on them,
which is great, by the way. And Kyle Mann,
thank
is
you,
fantastic,
thank you.
I mean, and like perfect guy to have on a Kentucky podcast.
Right. Very easy to do from my end. Very easy to just let Rob cook, let Kyle cook. But I prefer Reed. I said so at the end of that podcast. I had like changed my mind over the course of the conversation going between the two of them, but I'm still preferring Reed because of a lot of the stuff that we're talking about. I think if I were to sort of synthesize it, I would say Rob has the more electric, like traditional offensive creator tools. Mm-hmm. Someone could make the argument that Rob is the better offensive prospect. I don't know if I would necessarily agree with it, but I would hear that argument out.
Sure,
it's just that to really hit in the NBA for Rob, he is going to have to be so offensively brilliant that his team really comes to rely on him as probably a top two option. If he's going to be a starting point guard, then he's probably going to have to be a top two offensive option on his team, because he's not going to be able to provide the defensive value if he's anything less than that. And he might be good enough to do that. I'm not like begrudging anyone.
It's possible. Yeah.
Right. But the problem is that being a top two offensive option is one thing if you're on the Washington Wizards or the Charlotte Hornets, but if you're expected to beat other top two offensive options, now are you going to be better than CJ McCollum or Zion Williamson when you play the Pelicans? Are you going to be better than De'Aaron Fox or Domas Sabonis when you play the Kings? And you start to see that like every other top two offensive option in the league is just more physically gifted than Dillingham is. And Dillingham is like so skilled and like so electric and has such great touch. Like I love
the
watching
touch is
him
otherworldly. Like there was a play in the Tennessee game yesterday where he like was trying to drive, got sort of bumped off his spot. It was like one of those things where it was like the worst and best of him in one play where it's like, there wasn't like a great counter response to it. And he just sort of like chucked up this floater that was from like 15 feet that like went in. And like got and one call off of it. And it was like, I hated everything about that process wise. And I thought that was like a bad shot to take in that situation. Like you should have just pulled it out. Like you could have counted. Like there was like nine other ways he could have handled it. And it still went in. And it was just like, that is a special trait in a player. And I think where I get kind of bogged down with Rob, like what I'm more bullish about him is that, like I mentioned earlier, like these guys who are stubbier and skinnier, which he is, like he's not going to measure with a 6'5 wingspan. He's going to tip the scales at 175 pounds. He's going to be light. And the defense is really bad. Like the defense is very, very bad right now. It's bad on the ball.
Right.
He's not a great off the ball player in terms of even like attentiveness. Like he falls asleep quite a bit off the ball. He's had some turnover issues in conference play. But I just go back to like, a lot of these guys have something that made them special. And when Rob is cooking, it feels electric. And he has this unbelievable shot-making touch. He gets to the rim a little bit more than you think. He's a little bit better at the rim than you would think.
Right.
And he has this sort of like glitchy athleticism where it's not even a fluidity or anything. It's just like it feels like you're watching a video game and like a couple frames got skipped and all of a sudden he's over there. And it's not something you see too often. But in the absence of like the passing that somebody like Trae Young had, with the defense being such a negative, like, is that enough? Like, is that enough to get him over the special bar where he can be a starting point guard on a good team? I still don't know.
Right.
Like, I have him more like late lottery range, where it's like, I'm interested. Like, I think a lot of the stuff he does is fantastic and you got to draft who's there at the end of the day. I just wish there was like one other thing than like,
of course. Look, I don't think you don't need to feel bad about that eval at all. Like, I think I think it's reasonable. I think I have him like eighth or ninth, there. All of that special stuff is how a kid that size is an NBA player, like is a clear NBA player. It's just, if you are putting together a team and you're like, well, our goal is to win a title down the line, then, well, what, not even a title team, but just a contending team, like, you're going to have to wait out the defense with Rob, which is going to be painful and long. And if you decide to do that, then it means that you are going to give him a lot of offensive leash, because you're going to say like, well, we're not drafting him as a defender. We're drafting him for his offensive skill. So we got to give him the chance. And then he runs into that problem I said, where he's just going to play lots of very talented offensive players that are bigger than him and longer than him. Like, he can like give a whiff of sort of Kyrie creativity around the rim, which is amazing to see in a prospect. But Kyrie's like 6'4" with like a 6'7" wingspan. He's just like a
Kyrie's
bigger,
long. Yeah.
He's a bigger guy. And so like, that's the thing with Rob, is even if it does hit, because the NBA is so saturated with talent, you don't have to worry about that guy really killing you. What I think, something that I said on my episode with Kyle, is that once the NBA expands into Seattle and Vegas and the talent pool dilutes a little bit, I could see Rob becoming more comparatively valuable, because then those two teams are going to need offensive talent to come from somewhere. They're going to take it from the rest of the league in some capacity. And then there'll be a little bit more of a premium on like electric offensive talent. So you're just going to want that creativity on your team. But that's sort of a vague bet to make, to have him ranked higher than Reed, who I think is, you know, Reed has such a breathtaking statistical profile. Like, I understand the people who have him real high, like top three high or something, because some do. But I think deceptively, like, the framework I look at with Reed is he going to provide more value defensively or offensively to a team? And to me, the answer is clearly offensively. Because even though he has these great stock numbers and he shows this great timing on jump shots and on like help and stuff, you are still asking so much for a 6'2 guy who's not a breathtaking athlete. Like, who is he locking up? Whose life is he making so hard in the world of like really
the NBA
blessed
5 years from now too? Like, that's the thing. It's like, it's probably going to continue to get bigger and more athletic and skilled higher up the positional spectrum.
Right. And I think he will still provide value defensively. I think as sort of a defensive connector piece, he can still have a lot of utility, but like, naturally, as his defensive value has to be tested against just really blessed bigger players, then naturally his meal ticket will shift to the offensive side of the ball, in terms of, well, that's okay if you can't guard Jason Tatum, who can, like, what are you providing on offense to help beat Jason Tatum on the other end of the floor? And because Reed has this unbelievable like shooting projection to me, like, not necessarily as a movement guy, but in terms of his range and his quick trigger and his decision-making off the dribble. Like, I see a very, very good offensive player in there. Really good. With enough of a defensive base to get those 20 minutes a night that we're talking about so that he can allow himself to improve. So that his value could be a little more open than Rob's, which is going to have to be pretty narrow and like very, very offensively tilted. So like to me, Reed is the safer bet.
I agree. I think part of it with Reed too, I think he did a really good job of outlining sort of where I'm at with the defensive stuff. Cause I feel like a lot of the time with his defense, people just be like, oh, well, like he's getting these big numbers and they won't scale up. And I'm like, I feel like that's just kind of reductive. Like, I think that's just not I don't think that really gets the heart of anything. I think your point of like, what does this look like positionally matters a lot. Cause even if you look at like the guys who were considered the best guard defenders in the NBA, they are generally a little bit bigger than Reed is. And Reed, I will say, and I think this is part of why I'm bullish on Reed and have him as a top five player. Reed is both bigger and I think a little burstier than he gets credit for. I think people sag on the physical evaluation of him a little bit more than they should. I think both like in terms of just downhill ability, lateral agility, and like power and ability to kind of hold his ground when he does get cross-matched. I think he's a little bit better at those things, but I think you kind of hit the nail on the head of like, okay, maybe he's going to be like a really good guard defender, but does he have the things that make him like an excellent guard defender?
Yeah. He's not Jalen Suggs.
Exactly.
And that's fine. Like, and he also never makes a false step. I mean, I guess he kind of like, he'll fall asleep like other people can, but he is so confident, especially on offense, about where he wants to go. And he's so decisive and he makes decisions so quickly that like that adds a little like half step, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So to where there will likely be somewhere else on his team, like there will likely be a teammate of his that an opposing defense or an opposing offense would rather identify as a mismatch. And that's really all you need. As long as you aren't the
food
guy
on the court,
then like your offensive talent can keep you around. And I think you have the opportunity to grow.
Yeah, and I love the offensive talent. I think you were so spot on too with just like his knowledge of where he wants to get on the court. And I think he's even done a better job of like everything felt very left to right crossover to me early in the year, which like is a move that he's very good with. But even like in the Tennessee game, like there were a couple times where he went somewhere a little bit differently than you'd expect him to go, or like he's stepping back a little bit more. And obviously, like you want guys to get to the rim, but you need to have that balance and you need to have different ways to shake defenders and create space. And I feel like he's done a much better job of that. And if you do give him just an ounce of space, he pulls up. Like you cannot give him an inch on the perimeter. And when you have that ability to make guys pay if they go under or give you room or just are playing too far back in early offense, like there's just a lot of ways that he's able to punish you. And I think the passing decision-making is like really solid too.
I think it is as well. And I think it's just going to get better in the NBA because, you know, Kentucky's better space this year than it has been in years past, but it's still like you got Bradshaw or Onyenso. There you go. In the middle frequently. And in the NBA, he will play in a five out system sometime in his first 3 years. And once that happens, you'll see the decision-making will really pop. So will Rob's for that matter. Mm-hmm. But because of the other stuff we were saying, I think Reed especially will show his value. He also has the ability, in my opinion, and like the core strength to like pull up from 25, 26, 27 as he gets older. And so he'll start stressing a defense that way, which will again get him into space and allow him to do his thing. But I agree on the crossover thing. It was sort of like the when you see the videos of LeBron doing his, like, I'm falling asleep dribble, like, into his jumper. It was sort of, like, with the same frequency. Reed was like, oh, and I'm going right. And you're like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's those things where it's, like, it was working. Like, I didn't want to knock it too hard. Exactly. But, I think that's, like, the one area that has given me a little bit of hang up with him is that does Rob get, like, too carried away at times? Yes. But I do think there is real value in having that sort of creativity and fluidness as a creator with the ball and thinking here's all the different options like that I have to go to something to get myself room. Where with Reed, it feels like a lot of times if there's a ball screen coverage that's a little bit more aggressive, whether it's like a hedge or like we're going to double it or whatever, blitz a screen. Like, he just doesn't really have a ton to get around that. Now, are teams at the NBA level going to be like, you know, we should hedge, which is a coverage you rarely see in the NBA in 2024 every time he has the ball because he doesn't have a great way to counter that? Probably not. But it does give me a little bit of pause that, like, when he is met with more aggressive coverage, it seems like his decision process is more just like, I don't really have anything to do about this, so I'm just going to move off the ball. And that's fine. Like, there's worse decisions to make in that context. But I do think his handle and creation can be a little bit more limited than some.
I think that's right. And I think you, again, if you're valuing Reed high, and right now I have him high somewhere, probably like 5 or 6.
Yep.
Then you are sort of projecting him to at minimum be like third best player on a good team. You know, and if you're going to do that, that means, you know, he's starting a lot. And if he is going to not be your primary guard, if he's going to be an off guard, then he's going to be a really, really good one. Like, will be, again, better than his counterparts in that role. And so I think that's where, like, you really, like, I'm really leaning on his shooting, because I agree, if you do sort of the top two initiator question with him, I think some of the stuff you're saying does crop up. But at the same time, if Reed is commanding so much defensive attention that they're like blitzing him, then he's still putting his offense he's still putting his offense in a good position, you know. Mm-hmm. And because he's always getting off the ball, his team decides, well, we want to use you in more of a tertiary role than a primary or secondary one, then I trust his ability to move off the ball well enough to where he will still be able to access his decision-making. He'll still be able to get the ball in space. He'll still be able to use his range to where he is providing the very solid value. But, like, it's interesting. Like, there is still enough. I think there's enough of a question mark for some skepticism to be warranted, but you see every time this kid takes more than 10 shots in a game, like, what was he yesterday? He was 7 of 10 from 3 and 9 of 14 from the field, like, scoring 27 on 14 shots. Whenever he decides, like, I'm looking for my shot, it's like, well, here's 25, 8, 5, 2, and 2. And you're like,
yeah,
far be it from me to, like, I was like, sure, yeah. Like, how can I not have you up there? You know, so that's my thing with him.
For sure. So we're going to take one more break. We're going to talk about some of the other guards that are sort of in the mix in this 2024 class. So stay with us. All right. So looking at some of these other players in this mold that are higher up on boards, I think one of the first guys that comes to mind for me is Jared McCain. Mm-hmm. McCain has just been on a heater as a scorer this year. The playmaking, he hasn't really gotten to run the offense a lot because they'd like to run things through Proctor. They've let Kyle Filipowski initiate a little bit more this season. They've got
still have Roach and
who's like a good, just solid college point guard. So he's been a bit more tertiary, but the scoring is there. Some of the other indicators that I talked about in the column are there, like the block rate's not there, but he's a really good rebounder.
Really good.
His size, he's going to have that sort of stocky build coming in. I'm not sure on the wingspan for him. But just kind of a conundrum for me, because a lot of times with these smaller guards, that if you're talking about somebody that size that's in that top 20 mix, usually we usually get to see him on the ball a whole lot more than we've got to see McCain this season. What do you make of him? Because he's a guy where, like, I think there's some real evident takeover ability that's and some solid playmaking, but
yeah, what is the policy on cursing? On
you could curse, you're fine, you're good.
Okay, so I think Jared McCain is, like, cool as shit. Like, yeah. I love watching him do his thing, and I think he's very smart. Mm-hmm. Like, I forget what his rim numbers are, but he's shooting over 50% from two, so his rim numbers are probably like high 50s, or like in that area. Maybe he's touched 60.
He's less ground bound than, like, the block and dunk numbers would suggest, and I think it's because when he gets up off one first off, which is a good thing to see. But he's not a guy that like wilts against contact. Like he still kind of rises through it, even though he's not a crazy high vertical guy.
And he knows when to try to finish and when to like take an extra dribble under the hoop and kick it back out. Like he has a very advanced sense for when the help is going to give him a problem and when he thinks he can beat it. He also will do something where like he'll rise up maybe a step before you think he's going to try to surprise a big that's sort of trying to measure him. Like he has lots of little itty bitty tricks to try to help him compensate for his height, which is really cool. But again, like NBA, for whatever people want to say about NBA defense and how the rules are written, like guys who are in recovery defense on NBA teams are like, they're very talented and their timing's really good. And so the question is like, how much do you bank on McCain's brain to be able to get something at the rim at the NBA level to where he is approaching a three-level scorer? Because if you start to say to yourself, as good a shooter he is, he's really only going to be a two-level scorer in the NBA, then the value starts to go down. Because it's like, well, then why am I taking a two-level scorer who's 6 feet tall, whose defensive issues are always like going to be there? There's always, you know, always could just try a wing out there who's probably going to provide us more defensive value than Jared does. But if you bank on the brain enough to where you think there's some three-level stuff in there, that's where I think like a top 20 valuation makes sense. I've gone back and forth on whether I'd have him that high. Again, in this draft, to me, Jared McCain is a clear NBA player. Mm-hmm. So if he's a clear NBA player, at least for a first contract, then, you know, rank him 16th or whatever, wherever you want to put him. And you won't like, it'll probably be okay. But I think that in terms of his role, like, he's going to have to be like a point of attack defender in order to really like hit into subsequent contracts. And he's young enough to where you're like, well, Van Vliet is that, but Van Vliet is also an outlier. So you're really, it's a riskier bet than it seems. I could see why a team would rather say like, just give me Daron Holmes. Like Daron has all these great statistical indicators. He's big. Like maybe his role is a little fuzzy between 4 and 5 and who he guards, but like, just give me the size. Mm-hmm. And I could see a lot of teams making that calculation, but McCain, smart guy, like great shooter, really good shooter.
Real good, yeah.
And so he can be a part of a very good offense. It's just navigating the at-rim stuff and what on defense he's going to be able to provide, how long you want to wait that out. Is he more of a second draft guy? Is he more of a second team guy? Or is there a way for his first team to realize the fruits of drafting him? What do you think?
Yeah, I do think that there's like a real good first team path. I think part of me thinks that he might have a safer median outcome than some of these guys because the scoring is as potent as it is, especially mm-hmm. like just coming in with like such a strong pull-up game in particular. Like I think that is a really nice buffer to have when you're entering the league. Just like the fact that he's willing to pull with as much difficulty and range as he is off the trigger, I think matters quite a bit. Where I get a little bit scared is just like we've not seen him initiate a whole lot, and
he doesn't really separate on drives much with like a guard defender who's sticking on him. I've noticed that.
So if that limits what he's able to do with the ball in his hands, and then he's like a little bit inefficient, and that he's also like trying to figure out this defense thing at the same time, like. Mm-hmm. That's where it gets ugly quick. I think there are still like really solid like Peyton Pritchard-y outcomes in there too, where it's just like this is a guy that you can bring in off the bench and like he like will be like one of the true kind of guards that can actually operate a second unit in this day and age, where it's like there is flamethrower shooting, there's a range, there's a degree of toughness and physicality, and you're good. Yeah.
I think especially for regular season too. I think.
Yeah.
You've got someone out. You need someone to step up and not like kill your offense. And like, he will be able to do that. I mean, that's why I think he's like a borderline top 20 guy.
That's like right around where I've had him. I wish I was a little bit more in love with him, and I know that there are people that are. I'm just not quite there yet, but I think it's going to be one of those things where he's going to be a guy where he's on one of those teams that when you're not in a position to do this for a living, like you're watching a lot of guys when you watch Duke, and it's going to be a lot of just like, let's go through all of the Jared McCain ball screen possessions and just see like how good are his setups? How many things is he reading? How advanced are the reads that he is making? Like, it's going to be a lot of that before I kind of like put my foot down on where I ultimately decide to rank him. Let's talk about some of these other guys. I know one guy that you mentioned was Jamal Shedd. How are you feeling about him? Cause he's a guy with like a lot of fans because the defense is there and the body is there. And the intelligence is there. Like he's a really good playmaker, like talking about ball screen setups and just like ability to read the floor and these like really fast, just whips to the open man in a variety of ways. It's just like, is there enough scoring there? Like the three has always been a question for him. Like, to me, he's more of a, I'm doing what I did with Craig Porter and hoping he's a found money undrafted guy than like someone I'm prioritizing with a pick. Unless I see something in the pre-draft process as an NBA team that I'm like, all right, well, let's maybe if I'm like how Denver drafted Jalen Pickett, like if there's a team in that situation where it's just like, we think this guy's really good. And if we can get him for cheap and then like in a year we can play him and it'll be fine. Like maybe that is a kind of organization that could make sense of it. But otherwise, I think he's more of like a UDFA.
Yeah, I would take him in the second round. I'd be happy to take him in the second round. I think, you know, so few guys in the second round hit anyway that if you're like, if nothing else, he is going to defend so hard all of the time that it'll be good for like your team's culture. It'll be good for your training camp, for just sort of guard competition. Like, I know that isn't the greatest source of value in the world, but it's not nothing.
It's like better than not an NBA player. It's right. Better value, which like I say a lot with like second round guys. It's like if you just think a guy is an NBA player in the second round, like you should probably just take him.
Right. And there are things that he can do defensively. Like there are teams where he could walk in and be like one of the three best guard defenders on the team. Not just like not just among point guards, but among like all point of attack candidates, no matter how tall they are on the team. Shedd could maybe be in like the top three in a given unit as like a rookie, which is really impressive. And what we've been talking about in the first half of the episode, where you have to, once you get away from the stars, like kind of look at defensive stats and see if there's something there. He's got that, you know, and so competitive, so well conditioned. And like, his team's the number one team in the country. I think UConn's going to repeat. That's just me. But Houston is the best defense by like a mile, and a lot of it has to do with him. So like, I wouldn't go crazy and say I'm going to take Jamal Shedd in the 20s, because you know the height is a factor there. But in the second round, I would say sure, why not? Unless you feel very confident about some other wing, and when you're in the second round, the wings you're going to be getting pretty flawed. I think you could give Shedd a shot and put him with, you know, Fred Vinson or whatever shot doctor you have on staff and see what you can get out of him. Cause I think there's, you know, the Pelicans themselves got Jose Alvarado UDFA, and he was a positive player year one and helped them make the playoffs year one. So there is value to the archetype. You just have to, you know, you just have to hit on it. I think he has a decent chance of hitting on it.
Sure. So let's do, I feel like two other guys in this mix that come up a lot, I feel like that are just consistently on the most draft boards, are Tyler Kolek and KJ Simpson. Kolek is similar to Shedd, a really good passer, and I think someone that has a really high level of feel for the game. I think defensively, they're just not the same. I think Kolek is really strong. Like, he's another one of these guys that's going to come in like probably 190, 195, like ready to be a physical body on an NBA court. I just don't think he moves as well, like vertically, laterally, you name it. And I think while he is a good shooter, I just don't know how translatable that shooting is. He's a guy that doesn't really hunt the jumper, but he's always been good off the catch, barring like one really bad shooting year. And even that year, he was okay off the catch. I just worry about how the offense translates. Like, I just don't know that he gets to the rim as much at the next level. I don't know that teams are going to respect the shot if he has the range to expand it to NBA. Because, like, looking through my notes, I just don't have a whole lot on him, like, pulling up from NBA. It seems like he's just near the line a lot. I've been a little bit lower on Kolick. We have guys on our team here, no ceilings, that swear by him, that love him, to just buy the competitiveness, the tenacity, the toughness, the rebounding. Like, there's really good indicators for him. To me, he almost falls more into that, like, that's a guy I'm okay missing on.
Yes.
Category, where it's like, if he is playing 20 minutes for a game for you, it's probably a situation where, like, yeah, but like, are you still going to be able to trade him for a first round pick? Probably not.
Right. That's great way of looking at it. Yeah.
So I'm just not like super, super, super interested.
And it might be just the games I've watched of him, but mm-hmm. like, when he plays a team with an NBA caliber guard defender, when he's played Devin Carter, when he's played Steph Castle, I just don't see him creating separation. I don't see him putting those guys in a bind. Like, there is not anything about Kolick that demands my attention. You know, Jamal Shedd is very competitive, and he has like a 5 block rate and like a 3.5 steal rate. That gets my attention. With Kolick, I just don't, for a lot of the same reasons you say, I just don't see it. I would honestly probably prefer Reese Beekman to him. So
yeah, I think that's reasonable.
Yeah, like, and I'm not a crazy Reese guy, but I just feel a little bit more comfortable about his defensive projection and his shooting stroke, like, just enough, his decision making just enough. I could see him surviving. Don't know if I would prioritize him with a pick in like the top 45, mm-hmm. but I could see him maybe catching on.
Yeah, I just think it's really tough for guys that don't possess a giant threat to score when they translate up, and like, they're going to kind of have to be on the ball to bring value. Like, right. Tyler Kolick's best offensive skill is his passing. And if he's not a threat to score, and I don't really trust the range, it's hard for me to buy in. And like, to your point, yeah, like against UConn, 7 points on 11 shots. And like, Seton Hall is a great guard defender team. And like, he had a big assist game against them, but he also had 4 points on 6 shots and 5 points on 6 shots against them. Like, I just worry about like how scalable any of that is with him. KJ Simpson is an interesting one to me because I feel like I go back and forth on him, and I'm trying really hard to get over like an anchoring thing with him where like, I just caught like bad games of him like twice early in the year. And I've had to like mentally be like, he's not that guy. Like, he's not that guy. Like, keep watching the good ones, keep watching the good ones. Like, he's good. I really like the hands with him on defense. I think he does some really smart playmaking stuff off the ball. And I think it helps that he's just like a really good spot up player. Like, he's a really good shooter off the catch. He's a guy where I need to look deeper into the like actual playmaking tape to see how he sets everything up and how I feel about it. But in what I've seen, acknowledging that I need to go deeper on him because that's a team where I'm a little bit more focused on Cody. I'm a little bit more focused on Tristan Da Silva. Mm-hmm. He's a guy that does check a lot of the necessary small guard boxes as well. I wish he was a little bit bigger and stronger, but really solid player. How are you feeling about KJ Simpson? Cause I can't quite get to like that same thing like you were talking about where he's like a priority for me in the draft. But I think he does enough stuff that I'm like, I could be a nice NBA player. Like, I see that more for him than I do for Kolick.
Yeah. KJ leaves me perplexed because he has the indicators of being able to play up a little bit. You know, he does get up off of 1 foot. He does rebound pretty well. Pretty good college guard defender, you know, not physically overwhelming guys, but very competitive. And then he, like, his assist to turnover ratio is insane. His range is very, very good. I would prefer him to Kolick. Ultimately, if you're asking me, I don't know that there's anything that he does that grabs me enough to make him a priority. Probably falls in the I'm okay passing on him lane with like, mm-hmm. There's enough other options, but I could see him catching on. I mean, he's really smart, all around offensive player, has some athletic juice. He just is more offensively tilted. Whereas, you know, a lot of the support, like, my philosophy, if you're not a complete stud, is to for a small guard is like, well, can you hang on defense first? And with him, it's enough of a question, or there's enough other better options to where I'd probably pass until you're, again, you're in like 40s or 50s range. But that doesn't mean he can't hit. I mean, it doesn't. I wish that he were more, I wish he would like put, like he could be more dominant from two
a little bit.
I wish like he had that sort of bag where he was like constantly wrong footing guys and getting himself easy looks. I don't quite see that just enough for him to like put him in a first round discussion. But there are people I respect who have him there because like the productivity's there and he's still only like 21 and, you know, he's very good. I think Colorado, you know, there's a world where they make the Sweet 16 and he's probably the best player on the court in those games. So like I would love to see him succeed in a big way because I think it would add important context to this discussion about like, well, where was the major value from him so that you can evaluate him moving forward. But like, I don't feel confident enough on it to put my foot down to use your term.
So just one last guy so that we can get the SEO necessary, to keep the bills paid here, Bronny James, which I don't know, like Bronny to me, it's just like go back to school, but, to me, I feel like a lot of the stuff that we've covered is like actually in his favor. It's part of why I was pretty bullish on him coming into the year. I think he's vertically a pretty good athlete. I think he's very strong. I do think the shot gets back on track.
Somewhat more likely to get a second chance in the NBA.
Yeah, a little bit more likely. He's got some things going for him. But with him, like it's like a much more extreme version of like the Reed Shepherd handle situation where like he really just doesn't have a way to make anybody pay right now. And he just doesn't have any way to like break anybody down off the dribble at the moment. Would you have like any interest in him if he came out this year beyond like an undrafted thing? Like, would you even think about it?
Like assuming that LeBron James doesn't sign with my team if I draft his
sure. Son, yeah. 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 Like if we're removing all hypotheticals about getting,
LeBron. Yeah, I would find other options I like better, but like the irony for him is not only do I think he should go back to school, but I could see him being like eight, like by the time he's good. Like a senior in college, like a solid, like really solid, maybe all American Division I college point guard who then will have worked himself into getting a real shot in the NBA. The irony with him is that he's probably going to get a real shot in the NBA before that. So the question is what's better for his long-term talent development. And like, maybe it's a transfer portal. If you don't think that like Enfield is the guy to get that out of you, I tend to think it's somewhere in college that he can find somewhere that is right for him. But by the same token, if he's going to get guaranteed money, like who am I to tell him not to take guaranteed money?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, not that he needs it, but still.
Yeah. 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 But it'd be nice to have your own money. Like if I don't know, like,
sure. It would.
I think that's like a semi underrated part of that discussion with him. Like, I doubt his dad is like, I love giving my kids millions of my dollars. Like I'm sure he's more than willing to help. I doubt it, but
we'll see.
But yeah, well, Chuck, I appreciate you taking the time. Where can people find you and consume all of your work?
I'm Chucking Darts on Twitter, the Chucking Darts NBA and Draft Podcast, wherever you get them. I have a YouTube channel that's Chucking Darts. If you search for me, you'll find me. And you know, that's still basically in its infancy, but I'm posting videos of all my episodes there. Just follow me on Twitter. That's the best way to get all my stuff. But thank you very much for having me, Maxwell. I'm glad we got to do this home and home. This was great.
For sure. Yeah, Chuck is one of the best guys in the space, so make sure you're following him, listening to every episode of the podcast. A lot of good NBA stuff, a lot of good draft stuff. And just you do such a great job of balancing and I think assessing the draft process and understanding what the modern league is. And I think that's something that can be missing in a lot of draft content. So definitely check out everything that Chuck is doing over there. Make sure you subscribe to your No Ceilings NBA on your podcast feed of your choice, NoCeilingsNBA.com for a Substack for daily written content, No Ceilings NBA on YouTube as well. We appreciate you all joining us and we'll see you next week.